Now entering Nerdist.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Today We Learned. How's everybody doing today? It's middle of September. It's almost Halloween. It's going to have a lot of cool movies coming out and all of that. And this is one of those movies is we got the writer on the show today. His name is Simon Barrett, and he's a writer, director, producer. He's written and done works such as VHS, You're Next, Frankenfish, and out in theaters right now, the direct sequel to the Blair Witch Project, currently in theaters, it's titled The Blair Witch. And he wrote it, and it's a really great movie, and you guys should go watch it and all of that stuff. But before you go watch it, listen to this episode. He's on this podcast. And we also have a great guest host today, as usual. He's been on it a few times. A good friend of mine, David Sullivan. He's here chit-chatting with me and Simon about fun facts. We get into a lot of some fun things here. So I'm going to stop rambling on. First off, I also want to say it's glad to be back because this is I haven't recorded a podcast in almost a month now because I was in Japan and we banked a bunch of episodes, and now we're getting back into recording some new episodes, and we got this one, and then we got some other fun ones coming up too for you guys that I'm excited about. So get excited about those guys. Also, when you're done with this, we've been having a lot of fun activity on Twitter and all that. So keep tweeting at us and keep following us on Twitter and all that. I love to open up my TWL podcast on Twitter thing there and see a bunch of notifications. So please continue doing that. Send us facts and all that jazz But right now, we'll get into this episode. So with David Sullivan and I. So today we learned number 151 with Simon Barrett.
Gentlemen, let's broaden our minds.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Today We Learn. I'm happy to be back. This is a lot more current of an episode. All the previous episodes, obviously, you guys know things and you guys are smart. We had them in the can because I was in Japan for 3 weeks, but I am back and I'm excited
alive.
To be back. Alive. I'm
yes.
back alive.
Caught in a typhoon.
Yep, caught in a typhoon. I decided to, against better judgment, I hiked Mount Fuji in a level 2 typhoon. That was pretty dumb. It was the most dangerous, dumbest thing I've ever done. And I do a lot of dumb things. With me guest hosting today is occasional guest host.
Yes.
Great friend of mine. He's dressed up like a construction worker right now. He's got a sleeveless Nike basketball shirt on.
I didn't
have
an extra t-shirt in my car. I'm very sorry. This is no disrespect to you. I mismanaged myself this morning.
Very good friend of mine, Mr. David Sullivan.
Hello.
Guest hosting on the ones and twos.
Yes.
Over here. And with us, we got a great guest here. I'm excited to talk to this gentleman. Not only is he a great writer of films, and he's a director and producer and all that.
Actor.
And he's an actor. Mm-hmm. He's got a new movie out that he wrote. He's writer, director, producer, known for such works as VHS, You're Next, Frankenfish, and the direct sequel to the Blair Witch Project, currently in theaters, now titled The Blair Witch. But there's also a side note that I'm gonna talk to you about. It was in your publicist. It was like almost like a throwaway line. I'm like, whoa, let's get more into that. So we'll talk about that in a minute also. But Mr. Simon Barrett, thank you
yes.
for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Cool. Yeah, I love it back here in the Meltdown headquarters.
Yeah. You said you shop here.
I do. This is my comic book store. I like the way it's laid out. It soothes my OCD brain.
Okay.
Yeah, I find it easy to find things, even though they're organized in a way that really doesn't make any sense.
Okay. You just have to wash your hands after touching every comic book twice?
Yeah, exactly. And then spin around seven times.
Sure. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, and the usual.
Uh-huh. Simon, you have The Blair Witch out, or actually just Blair Witch,
mm-hmm.
And that's in theaters now. What was that like working on that real quick?
I mean, it's been a really long process.
Yeah.
You know, we started, I started writing the script back in I think March of 2013, and then we went off and made The Guest. And just there's been a lot of other projects kind of, starting in the interim. And, we filmed the movie last summer up in Canada, and, you know, so it still hasn't really sunk in yet that the process is over. That, you know, that regardless of anything else, you know, it's in theaters now, and I don't need to worry about it anymore. And there's nothing more I can do.
Yeah.
Although Adam and I did notice a typo in the credits.
No way.
Well, wait. I was in Austin last night, and we noticed it, and we haven't seen our credits yet because we, you know, they didn't finish them because the project was so secret they couldn't have them made because they had to have the words the title Blair Witch come up.
Oh, wow.
So they were held until the very last minute. So normally we're much more involved in approving our credits and picking the fonts and stuff. But in this process, you know, we were able to design the main titles, but we didn't see the credits themselves until last evening at the Alamo Draft House, watching them with Tim League, and we were like, wait a minute, what's that?
Witch is spelled with a TCH.
That's kind of the issue that we have is that the credit is that we don't really feel like we show the Blair Witch in the film, but that's a whole different, that's a whole another weird thing.
So, okay.
Anyway, it's a whole complicated subject, but yeah, you know, we'll fix it.
What did they spell? Was it just a name?
No. It was just a name that they used, a name that we don't think is accurate for what that character is supposed to be. You know, and
best script, you got to work harder.
We weren't directly involved, and right. I see how that mistake was made.
Yeah. Right.
It, by the way, it's not something that would like offend any actor or crew member.
Sure,
or anything.
Yeah.
It's not like anyone's name was misspelled or left out.
Sure,
that would be. You know, that would be embarrassing,
right? Yeah,
because then you would, like, are actually offending someone.
I gotta change my IMDb page.
This is only of offense to like Adam and I, but we think it could confuse some people if they're trying to like make, you know, figure out how everything works between the first film and our film.
Yeah,
sure.
So yeah, okay. So we want to make sure we get it right.
That's interesting. That's yeah.
As Hollywood goes, anytime there's a successful film of any genre, they try to find a way to make, you know, a sequel or something that's going to follow it up, whether it be a remake or whatever. When you saw the film initially, were you like, oh, I know a perfect way to continue this story or to create another story around this concept? Or was it just something that you didn't think about because you had your other things going at the time?
Well, I was still in college, so I wasn't exactly doing that.
Really?
Cultivating like sequels to you know, the films that I was seeing.
Mm-hmm.
But it did seem obvious to me that it had a really interesting mythology that I wanted to see continued in a direct way.
Yeah.
And so I actually didn't really think about how I would make a sequel to The Blair Witch Project until they made a sequel to The Blair Witch Project, Book of Shadows. And then I saw it and then I was like, well, that's not the obvious choice. You know, which in some ways is admirable, but you know, in others, they took a departure from what I thought was so unique and interesting about the first film.
Uh-huh.
And so that did, you know, I was having creative thoughts about this long before, cool. You know, the opportunity arose to actually,
mm-hmm.
You know, make those choices myself. So, you know, but so do I, you know, I think so did, you know, thousands and thousands of other Blair Witch Project fans.
Sure.
And,
I had a similar experience after watching Empire Strikes Back. I was well, this is not.
This doesn't work at all.
This doesn't work at all.
What a departure from what made the original truly great. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Agreed.
Aliens as well. And
yeah, like, and what, don't even Godfather 2? Come
get,
on.
Don't even get me started. It's like Robert De Niro is suddenly playing. He's a different actor.
Yeah. Flashbacks. Yeah. What is this?
Disastrous sequel.
Yeah. The sequel. It's like, did you ever watch Key and Peele?
Yeah.
Did you ever see that Gremlins writer's room for Gremlins?
Yeah.
Look at the sequel doctors.
Yeah, it's incredible. It is incredible, and I it couldn't have been too much different from that.
Simon, two things. We'll get to a fun fact or something you learned recently, but on your Wikipedia page here, it says you were born.
Which I did not have anything to do with the creation of, and is like only somewhat correct, but I like it.
It says you were born in 1978 or 1979.
Yeah, that's a good.
That's true.
That's a good example of like internet information.
Sure.
I was born in 1978.
78. Hey, Wikipedia.
Yeah.
1978. Right. You heard it here first.
Right.
MTV News.
That's funny.
Yeah, I don't know where. Yeah, I mean, who knows? I must have just like muttered something about my age in some interview. I mean, it's actually pretty. I mean, I don't know who made that Wikipedia page, but I'm overall pretty grateful that someone would take the time to like parse through, you know, go through a few of my interviews and try to like figure out like a through line.
Yeah.
You know, because most people's Wikipedia pages are made by either
companies
themselves or their publicists. And I've only worked with publicists, you know, fairly recently in my career.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and I'm not like Twitter verified or anything like that.
Yeah. Oh, so welcome to the club. They were Twitter was doling out verifications like the last 3 weeks.
Now,
and here us two are like, what's going on?
Now I think it's cooler to be unverified. verified.
That's right.
I don't know if I don't know if I'm going to try it because now everyone's verified.
Yeah.
Well, what we need to do is get verified and then unverify ourselves.
Can you do that?
You have power over that.
You can't. You can.
You can unverify yourself.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. You just change like some information, and they want to make sure that everything you initially put in there is correct. And mm-hmm. so once you start changing information, it's like, wait a second.
Yeah.
And you become unverified.
Oh, so all I have to do is like change my bio to like I'm Kate Upton.
Right. Exactly.
And they'll be like, oh, this guy.
I was born in 1979. Yeah. Whoa.
That doesn't check out.
Yeah. Yeah. I got verified pretty early on, and then I changed my profile picture, and then all of a sudden the next day my little blue check was gone, and I was like, hold on, because this was when like verification was like a big deal. And kind of freaked out a little bit.
Did you change it to a picture of someone other than
yourself? Just a different picture of myself.
That does seem a little unfair.
Very strange.
Well, they have their own reasons.
I guess they do.
Another quick thing I want to talk about is you work a lot with Adam, right?
Yeah
Adam Wingard,
of course.
How did you meet him?
We met on the set of a film I wrote called Dead Birds. We were both making horror films in Alabama back in 2003.
Okay.
And he just came with another pal of ours, Evan Katz, who did the movie Cheap Thrills and just directed the film Small Crimes. Then he came to they did like a set visit kind of just to see what was going on. We just kind of hit it off and stayed friends.
Because I seen he graduated from Full Sail University in 2002.
Yep. Yeah, same with Evan. Yeah.
I graduated in 2006.
So I was
curious.
Yeah, yeah. No,
from,
yeah.
From
I,
there?
I, from Full Sail, yeah.
Oh. Yeah, I did yeah. not. I didn't, I'm not. Okay. A, it's funny. I get a lot of...
Good for you. No.
I get a lot of messages. Oh, I don't know that the place I went was any better, but I get a lot of messages actually from Full Sail graduates that are like, you know, you're an inspiration. I'm like... Here's the thing. Like, Adam is an inspiration, you know. And, you know, I think, you know, Darren Bousman, there's a lot of Full Sail graduates. Yeah.
A lot of great ones who went out to do great things.
But, yeah, I'd never even heard of it until I met Adam, to be honest. You know, I was not too tapped into the film school community.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Simon,
mm-hmm.
we like to start off each episode with a guest providing a fact about themselves or something you learned recently.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What interesting stuff do you have today?
So, life is, of course, a process of learning.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm all full of interesting trivia. But this morning I was reading a really good article about how the U.S. government is deploying drones that are going to shoot vaccine-infused pellets all over Montana to try to rescue the black-footed ferret population, because the ferrets and the prairie dogs there both have, you know, the plague, which actually the government somewhat encouraged with the prairie dogs to try to exterminate them in the last century. We tried to wipe out that population and then only later realized that like completely destroyed a bunch of other species. So I was reading about drones that are going to shoot pellets at ferrets. But the ferrets aren't really supposed to eat the pellets. The prairie dogs are supposed to eat the pellets, and then the ferrets will eat the prairie dogs. And this is a government's plan, but it's very low tech. It's like the thing that's shooting the pellets is basically like a redesigned gumball machine.
That's amazing.
That they're attaching these drones. Yeah, I was reading this and I was like, this is I had no idea about so many aspects of this. Like the usage of drones. I think the thing that I like the most about it is that, like, you know, our government's kind of terrifying use of drones to intimately murder people. This is like the so positive version of that. We're shooting food pellets at little ferrets to make them feel better. And I'm like really excited about the people that are putting this together. And it's on like a wildlife refuge in Montana, and they're just going to shoot little food pellets everywhere and hope that it saves the ferret.
I feel like we think a lot better of drones in warfare if they just dropped pellets that gave people like dysentery.
Yeah, or like
maybe stop killing everybody.
Yeah, murdering people and also I mean, I have mixed feelings about drones, like, you know, potentially delivering our Amazon our Amazon orders. I have mixed feelings about that. I definitely can see. Well, the weird thing about all of this is that if you ever work on like a film shoot with like the drone camera, which we used one in The Guest and we used one pretty extensively in Blair Witch, where the characters actually have a drone camera that they're sending up to try to find their bearings. And that's a bit of a plot point, actually. And, the main thing on a film set that, you know, as soon as they like are going to turn on the drone, they're like, everyone get the hell away. Like, give this thing, you know, you're supposed to, they're, you know, obviously safety on a film set is a huge priority in every case. So there tends to be a bit of overcompensation on that, but but they're really like, get the hell away from this thing. It, you know, at any moment it could like dive towards you and cut your throat with one of its propellers, and you're like, oh God, you know, and then the next day, you know, you'll be like reading and it's like, Amazon's going to use a drone to like deliver, you know, a Roomba to your house. Right. And I'm like, how does that work?
Yeah.
How is this thing going to like come to my door and not like, you know, kill my cat?
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing. Like my brother has Prime. Mm-hmm. And I had him ship me some stuff the other day, and I'm like, "How does that work?" Because like I don't use Prime, so it was like I know a little bit about it, but I'm sure. Like, "What? How exactly did you get it overnight or whatever? If it's somewhere else?"
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, "And I knew he was fucking around." He's like, "Oh, the drone will Amazon drones deliver them next day. You just got to put out your drone pad." Uh-huh. And as soon as he said drone pad, then I'm like, "Okay, now you're fucking with me." But it got me thinking is. It might be something like that, to where it's got like a GPS coordinates or something with like it knows to land on a certain box or something. I don't know. I'm not a doctor, but I feel like it is scary to know that there's just going to be eventually things, and it's only a matter of time before the Amazon just gives the government X amount of dollars to okay it all.
Yeah, for sure.
We got all this weird Blade Runner shit flying packages around, lunchboxes around with like
And drones are getting smaller and smaller, and you know, there could be one in here with us right now, and we just have no idea. You know,
here's something that was interesting, like the ferret. I'm looking at these sizes here on Wikipedia.
Yeah,
and ferrets eat prairie dogs.
Yeah, I know.
They look like the same size.
They're not bigger than prairie dogs. They're just like incredibly meaner. apparently, like, you know, they're, you know, ferrets are, you know, the reason it's illegal to have ferrets as a pet in a lot of states is because they have a history of like attacking babies and things like that. Ferrets are, you know, they're weasels.
The claws, the fang, what is it that kills them?
Yeah, claws and they're weasels. Killing they're clever little, you know, predatory rodents.
Right.
And they, you know, they're really smart.
Right.
And they are pretty mean, and they will like, you know. Like, if you're Googling like ferret kills baby right now, you know, there's definitely no downside to do.
Oh, gosh.
You know, it's definitely going to be a really pot, you know, no way disturbing.
The diet. Ferrets are obligate carnivores. The natural diet of their wild ancestors consisted of whole small prey, meat, organs, bones, skin, feathers, and fur.
Everything.
Yeah. They're little garbage disposals.
Some ferret owners feed prey killed or live like mice and rabbits. That's wild.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't actually know how ferrets hunt prairie dogs. I don't know if like one ferret kills one prairie dog or if they like team up. Like coyotes or something. But I suspect they just kill a prairie dog because they're really mean and smart.
Right. Their teeth are pretty sharp. Like they got like full on fangs.
Yep. Yeah. Ferrets are scary. But they're also. You know, Kindergarten Cop, they're adorable.
They're adorable. Kodo and Podo.
Beastmaster. I mean, so, you know, so their nature's little jesters. and also, you know, they maybe will kill your children.
Yeah.
That's so wild. They're very deceiving.
Yeah.
With how adorable they look.
Well, see, I didn't know that. I did not know. That was one of the many things that excited me about this article, reading it this morning before going on the show, is I was like, there's so many things about this that are news to me, and one of them was that ferrets eat prairie dogs. Because you look at a prairie dog and you look at a ferret and you're like, the prairie dog would win.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely.
But the prairie dog does not, apparently, historically win. For sure. And so, to prevent the ferret from getting the plague, they're gonna try to, they're preventing the prairie dog from having the plague, basically.
That's wild.
And just the fact that all these animals have all these various plagues is kind of an interesting bit of trivia as well.
Yeah.
it's very like, how do they get these plagues? Is it something that animals in these species have been getting for millions of years, or is it something
passed down? Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, I guess in our nation's history, it has something to do with you know, I mean, it's transmitted through fleas, I guess, and I think 1900 is like the earliest case in America of the bubonic plague, but it's just one of those things that, like, you know, in an underground tight species of rodents spreads very quickly. And again, you know, I do believe that the government, unless I'm mistaken about this, in like the 1920s, I want to say the government kind of instituted tried to spread the bubonic plague specifically to black-tailed prairie dogs because they were messing up ranches. You know, horses would step in holes and break their legs and stuff. So they tried to wipe them out in the Southwest.
It didn't work.
It did work. And then we realized that it was like a horrible thing to do because they were a really important kind of step in the food chain. And we've been, they were endangered for a while. And we've been kind of trying to actually rebuild the species ever since. It was one of those funny things where it turns out that like wiping out an entire animal species, is a bad idea.
Yes.
And it has some like weird negative side effects that you know,
yeah.
Who would have known?
Yeah.
So it is interesting. And, you know, I was hanging out with some friends. I was in Toronto a couple nights ago, and one of them was talking about getting like a, I was hanging out with some girl and her boyfriend, and she wants to get a bearded dragon, and her boyfriend doesn't. And I was like, well, you know, they do carry like salmonella,
yeah.
and they were both like, what? I was like, oh yeah, you touch like a reptile, you got to wash your hands afterwards because they got salmonella, the bacteria lives inside them, uh-huh. and because they're not the most sanitary creatures, especially if you keep them in a little small aquarium, you know, they're kind of interacting with their feces on a regular basis,
yeah.
So you touch them, then you touch something else, yeah. and you've got salmonella.
Oh, jeez.
And I could tell that was I was creating problems in their relationship. So I changed the subject, but she was like, I'm going to Google this, and I was
right.
like, well, what are you finding? She's like, well, the results are mixed.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, yeah, well, they've got salmonella.
Right, right, right.
Like, I mean, not every lizard has salmonella.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to, like, you know, but a lot of them.
Right.
A lot of
don't
them.
Risk it.
There's a few different types of salmonella. And
get
the
a dog.
Cold-blooded animals, particularly reptiles, have S. bongori. Salmonella bongori, I guess, is one of the genuses of. There's two species of salmonella. There's Salmonella enterica and Salmonella bongori. And that's Salmonella bongori is the one that like the lizards and the dragons and all of them have.
So that's my trivia today: is all animals are diseased.
Yeah. I'll be honest, I didn't realize it. I thought it was just like a bacteria from like food, like
eggs,
raw food.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I didn't realize it was like something that is actually a carried disease.
No, I had to babysit a friend's bearded dragon. This was like 15 years ago, like right after college. A friend was going out of town, and she asked me to babysit her bearded dragon for a month. And I was like, yeah, sure, no problem. And then at some point she was like, oh, by the way, if you handle him, which you should do, otherwise he gets lonely. Which I was like, I doubt that very, very much.
Why is he not playing with me?
I mean, he's a lizard. He does not care.
He's good.
No. Yeah. He's like, can I eat this thing? No.
Right.
Oh, okay. Whatever.
Right.
No, I mean, he's a lizard, but she was like, you should take him out and play with him. I was like, yeah. And then she's like, but make sure you wash your hands afterwards, 'cause he carries salmonella. And I was like, wait, what? Like, I hadn't,
I wouldn't have agreed to this. What are you talking about?
Well, let's just say the lizard didn't get a lot of activity for that month. But also, he's a lizard, so I don't know that he noticed. I fed him crickets. Everything was fine.
Nice. Nice. Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah, they're gross.
Yeah, like, I mean, they're cool to look at, I guess. But even as pets, it's like I used to have turtles ages ago when I was, like, in sixth grade. And the upkeep, like the cleaning, the smell.
Not
is like
the smell.
Not a pet that you really... Like, to me, if you're going to have a pet, have something as, like, a companion that you can take. Mm-hmm. You can
well, here's the thing, like, I mean, even... So, say you've got turtles... I think turtles are pretty cute. I think they're, like, adorable, but they don't give a lot back.
No.
In fact, they're one of these species, like, skunks that have, like, such a great defense technique that they've basically not evolved at all since then.
Yeah.
And they're, like, skunks are interesting to me because you look at, like, skunks versus, like, possums or raccoons. And, like, a raccoon can, like, open a door
mm-hmm.
and, like, do a Rubik's Cube and stuff. Mm-hmm. They're, like, these, like, little crafty things that can, like, break into your house and like, open a jar and, like, steal your food. And skunks are like so dumb that you're like that they like see your car coming towards them and they're like just like huh.
Right.
And turtles are basically the same because skunks have this one awesome thing that makes nothing in the world want to mess with them.
Yeah.
And so because of that, they haven't developed any technique whatsoever.
Right.
It's like if you're like a 300-pound like 7-foot dude, you don't really need to like learn martial arts,
right.
Because you're huge.
Right.
And the skunks are just like they have this one awesome thing, so nothing has messed with them for like the last several thousand years,
right.
And because of that, they're just like the dumbest, stupidest things.
Yeah.
And they're like turtles. Uh-huh. They're like turtles. Turtles have this one awesome defense technique, and because of that, they're slow and they're stupid. And they smell,
mm-hmm.
and they. If you turn them over on their backs, they die. If they walk into the road, they are just like totally useless except for this one awesome technique, which is unbeatable. Which mm-hmm. is they can hide inside a rock that they create themselves.
Yep.
So I think about stuff like that a lot. But the thing about having a reptile that I learned with this bearded dragon is and you feed it crickets, which is entertaining but gross. And crickets themselves are disgusting and smell, and like they create a lot of feces too. And so if like for whatever reason the bearded dragon like has had its fill of crickets, and then like the crickets like then you've got a lizard and crickets. It's like a unique combination of like gross things that create bad odors, and if the crickets die
and annoying noises.
Well, and like and if they and they're loud, and if they die, they smell bad. They smell worse, of course, if they're dead. And so there's just like you know, I mean, look, I you know, I'm not that you know. Obviously, if a dog, you know, and you have to go out with a little bag and pick up its poop, you know, everything, you know, like the book says, everybody poops. And that's the one true fact of pet ownership. But, but you know, a dog feels like you're getting more out of it, whereas certain animals, it feels like the relationship is just...
me taking care of you.
Yeah.
Me putting up with you.
Poop upkeep.
Yeah.
Like, you're just really dealing with an animal that, like, eat, food goes in, poop comes out.
Right.
There's nothing else really going on with
it.
Right. And your job is to provide the food and clean up the poop. And, and yeah, I mean, to me, you know, I'm sure there's like a metaphor for some of my past relationships there, but I will say that, like, you know, like when I think about pet ownership, that's not, you know, that doesn't seem like one of the more enticing ones. That said, turtles are pretty cool.
Right.
I mean, they're very cool. It's a very cool creature.
Yeah.
But it also is like, if I'm going to put that much into something, I want something in return at least.
This, by the way,
I mean, look, if a dragon gets lonely, then I get lonelier way faster than a dragon.
Yeah, exactly.
I want something to like give me a time of day.
Right, something that'll be like happy when you come home. Like even a cat is happy for you know, at least it'll be excited to see you until you feed it.
Yeah.
You know, and by the way, this is going to be your least popular episode ever. Because we're literally like the most passionate people in the world are like pet owners.
Yeah.
At least online. You know, they're up there with like, you know, conspiracy theorists of various sects and and you know, and I think like if we can just go through the rest of this podcast and malign every pet, every animal.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Just like, you know.
That'd be great.
What's wrong with them? I mean, look.
I mean, look, I'm allergic to cats and cats are lazy.
I'm allergic to cats. I'm allergic to cats, but I like cats. But I also like that I have the allergy playing card that never will require me to live with one.
I'm sorry, I
like,
I
like it when other people have cats, and then I like it when I'm like, oh, your cat's bothering me, I have to leave. You know, sorry, it's my allergies.
Right.
Like, I gotta go. Otherwise, I'm really enjoying this party.
I use that. Oh, do you have cats? No. Somebody here has
Has one. Yeah.
I gotta leave.
Exactly. Somebody
here has cats.
It's true. And how can they prove that that's not true?
Right.
You know, somebody everywhere has a cat. Yeah.
Attention, everyone. Does anyone own a cat?
Yeah. Does anyone know somebody who knows somebody?
Yeah.
Just trying to find some reason that there was a cat there. Where were you with a cat 2 days ago? Yes, I got
it. Well, the sad thing is I'm allergic to dogs as well.
Oh, really? I didn't think dogs were hypoallergenic.
No, some are. Like poodles are hypoallergenic, I believe, and there are a few breeds that are. So if I ever get a dog, I'll have to do some research.
Yeah.
Right now, my lifestyle can't support a cactus.
Yeah. Yeah.
But dogs are great. You know, they allow you to make stupid viral videos.
Yeah,
that's kind of really what I want.
So you're traveling a lot?
I have been traveling a lot. I was in Cape Town, then I was in Toronto, then I was in Austin, and I just flew back here last night.
Is that for research or is that for the film, like you're doing the circuit, or is it like
Cape Town was scouting for an upcoming film, and then Toronto, we screened Blair Witch, like the official kind of world premiere, because we'd done some advanced screenings, but this was like the first real one where you could buy tickets. Was at the Toronto Film Festival in the Midnight Madness section, and then we went to kind of like our two, you know, Adam and my kind of like two homes, our two festival homes. Other than Sundance, I guess I should say it's been Sundance, but Toronto was like the first place that really showed our movies, and then Fantastic Austin. Fest in Austin. So Fantastic Fest is happening after our film comes out, but we kind of got to have like a mini Fantastic Fest screening. At the Draft House Theaters, and so that's where I was. Well, it's really weird, but that's where I was like, it wasn't last night. It was the night before last night.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. That makes more sense.
So they actually did something with one of your films. The film was actually, because they like to premiere films, or at least have the Austin premiere at Fantastic Fest.
Yeah. They do like a lot of U.S. premieres.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But you had a film that actually showed at South by before that, and the festival director, who you have a good relationship, likes your movie so much and likes your, you know, where you guys are headed so much, that they actually brought your film to Fantastic Fest.
Yeah, they let us have screen twice in Austin. Yeah,
yeah.
The guest, I think, screened at South by, and then Tim Leake was just like, you know what, I want to show it again. And
that's awesome.
But he made a point of it. He made a point of, like, I'm doing something that I don't ever
do.
We don't normally do this. You know, if a movie's already premiered in Austin, you know, we don't normally do this. But but it was super cool.
Yeah.
And that was a really fun screening. So
are you really active in that side of it? Because I know a lot of writers, like, kind of write. Sometimes they'll hang out on set, and then they'll just kind of let the movie do its thing. You've teamed up with the really good director that you've worked with a number of times, and like a production company. Do you kind of follow the film around? Like, do you do like Q&As? Do you do like different? Do you go to all the festivals?
Yeah, I mean, it depends. I mean, you know, I tend to work differently than most writers in that I'm much more involved in every stage of our productions, and that started because when Adam and I first started working together, I was kind of the main producer on those films.
Okay.
You know, and we filmed actually our first two features were filmed in my hometown.
Is that Missouri?
Columbia, Missouri. Yeah, yeah. And we shot the wraparound of the first VHS film there as well. And so I was much more involved in like every kind of phase of casting, hiring crew, getting equipment, forming like. I'm a member of, like, I think a couple defunct Missouri LLCs and things like that, you know, getting insurance and stuff like that. And fortunately, as our careers kind of got better following your next, I didn't have to do that stuff anymore, which was not why I got into filmmaking, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody gets into filmmaking to, like, debate insurance premiums.
Sure.
Look, not to disparage, you know, the UPMs and line producers, who that's their job, but they're better at that than I am.
Right.
But that was just the only way to get our films made, because no one else was going to do that for us.
Right.
So I was much more, you know, when we did, like, A Horrible Way to Die, it was really just, like, the two of us doing kind of everything.
Wow.
And we had other producers on that, you know, who helped in various capacities. But, you know, that project was really kind of one that we saw, you know, from beginning to end. And we had, I think, a 5-person crew on that film, counting the two of us.
Wow.
So you know, it was really hands-on. And, you know, occasionally, you know, I would do technical stuff and so on. Though mainly that's Adam's purview, because he tends to be way better at it than I am.
Yeah.
So it was like, you know, everything I kind of wasn't good at, Adam was good at, and vice versa. So we were a good team.
And then
as things have gotten easier, I can kind of more focus on, you know, just the creative side of things. But you know, at those initial screenings, you know, I was just there with Adam, and so it really depends. I mean, you know, if our movie's playing like an international festival, you know, they're just going to want to probably fly out at them, and that's totally fine.
Sure.
But usually it's more fun if it's the two of us.
Yeah.
So, you know, and this is, you know, like, this is just me, obviously. I mean, Adam's not here right now.
Oh, but, that's not him I'm talking to.
No, I don't know who that
He's been
guy
knocking.
Is.
I don't know. I thought he was your...
No, he followed me in. Yeah. We should actually call the police when this is over.
It's been here a while.
We do our own press and do our own kind of fun things that you know, amuse the two of us, you know, differently. But in general, the Q&As are kind of more fun if there's two of us.
Yeah.
Also, I've noted, and you'll probably witness this many times yourself, you know, at Q&As, you get asked the same questions over and over and over again. So it's nice to just take turns.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, okay, I answered that one last time.
Right. Why don't you take this
now you, and that way you don't, that way you can kind of keep your answers like lively and different and stuff. So we tend to have more fun doing press and Q&As and festival tours and stuff like as a team.
Right.
But you know, I mean, it just depends. I mean, Adam just finished shooting the U.S. feature adaptation of Death Note, the manga up in Vancouver, and that's totally his thing.
Gotcha.
And then I'm doing some stuff that's more going to be my thing, but I think he'll be like producing. And so, you know, so it just depends on the project and what it is. Yeah. Well, you know, we've been friends for, you know, 13 years now.
Yeah.
So, and we started, you know, kind of working together, I think, not just as friends, but kind of fans of each other's separate work.
Sure.
You know, like he liked what the films I'd written. I liked the films he was directing. And it was kind of like, let's collaborate from this place of like, not just friendship, but like, you know, artistic respect. And that kind of allows us to give each other both like, you know, like a lot of freedom, a lot of creative freedom to, you know, like I trust him to, you know, to do what he wants. And he does the same. So.
Right.
And so far, it's worked really well.
How did you come on board with this? Was this something that you pitched and you were like, ah, that's great, or just relationships, or?
Yeah, you know, we didn't even know who owned the rights to the Blair Witch Project, and it wasn't something that we'd really seriously thought about ever tackling. Even though we were friends with Eduardo Sanchez and Greg Hale, kind of two of the three main original filmmakers,
right.
And so we were curious, you know, because we worked with them on VHS too, because we were fans of their work and including the Blair Witch Project, But you know, it was something that Lionsgate, who bought Your Next, brought to us. They were kind of like, "Hey, we have this property, and we've been thinking about doing something new with it, but we don't know what that is, and we haven't found the right filmmakers yet, and we think it might be you guys. Are you interested?" And we really were like, "Yeah, absolutely." You know, it's an interesting thing because, you know, Lionsgate had bought Artisan, who owned Blair Witch Project, and but after Book of Shadows, nobody did anything. You know, it just kind of the franchise, which I don't even know if you can call it a franchise. At this stage, I guess you can because there's three films.
Sure.
But you know, it just was dormant for over a decade, and so they were just kind of like, you know, hey, listen, it feels like, you know, maybe the time's right to do another Blair Witch movie, and we're like, yeah, absolutely, yeah, let's do it. And that was it. Yeah.
I will interject with franchising stuff only because I also have a podcast called The Franchise, and we got into this debate with Ghostbusters and what makes franchises. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the Blair Witch had some sort like video games and like graphic novels and things like that.
Yep, video games.
And we come to figure out that if there's only like two movies of something, but there's ancillary works that are using the title,
like Slimer and the Real Ghostbusters.
Slimer and the Real Ghostbusters. And, yeah. If they're using the IP for other mediums, we kind of decided to consider it a franchise because you're using that IP to continue branching off.
Yeah, in which case the Blair Witch is such a weird franchise because the original film was such a cultural phenomenon.
Oh, man.
that there was just a glut of materials, some of which are pretty ridiculous. And like the first video game's cool, and then it gets kind of there's a quality drop off after that. You know, there is like this weird Blair Witch universe of video games, graphic novels. There's 8 young adult novels.
Oh wow!
The last 3 of which were only published in the UK, and they're way off the reservation in terms of the mythology.
That's wild.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So it absolutely is a franchise then, but it was a franchise that really lasted from 1999 to like October of 2000 and then was like done. And part of that's, you know, part of that it was the response to Book of Shadows, but part of that was also, you know, a kind of massive, if very brief, cultural backlash against what was essentially an incredibly innovative experimental film.
Mm-hmm, sure.
that just happened to get, you know, this massive theatrical release and was a huge hit, and then everyone in the world was like,
found footage.
Yeah, it was like, wait, god damn it. Well, actually, I mean, you know, that's another thing that I find interesting is Blair Witch Project, you know, still the most profitable film of all time.
Sure.
Came out in 1999, and no one really imitated the found footage thing until like 2007 or so.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. It wasn't until like Paranormal Activity.
When did you guys do VHS?
The first VHS we shot
2002,
in
2003?
No, we shot it in, we started shooting in January 2011.
Oh.
Okay. And it premiered at Sundance in January 2012.
Okay. Yeah, and okay. Cloverfield didn't come out till 2008.
Cloverfield was a big one. Obviously, the first Paranormal Activity. Wreck. Actually, Last Exorcism, I remember being which follows follows the Blair Witch. Well, Emily Rose wasn't found footage. Exorcism Emily Rose is a different film.
Different. It's not considered.
No, different movie. Exorcism Emily Rose is like a Scott Derrickson courtroom kind of horror film. And Last Exorcism is a found footage thing directed by, oh my gosh, I know this guy. Anyway, but Eli Roth was involved in it. Yeah. And Daniel Stamm is the director of Last Exorcism. He'd done another found footage movie that never really got a wide release, but that was kind of his little thing, his thing for a bit. And that really, that was, I feel like, what really started off that fad. And I feel like that's partially because those were the first movies that it's like, oh, okay, this is an imitable and cheap business model.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Blair Witch Project, which was so authentic, it was improvised, it was shot by its actors.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anyone really knew how to do that. And furthermore, I don't even think they knew if doing that was a good idea.
Yeah.
Because so many people, like, I think the Blair Witch Project got an F Cinema Score.
Wow.
Which is insane. Yeah, and Heather Donahue, who delivers one of the most amazing, bracing, and funny, like, improvisational performances ever, won the Razzie for Worst Actress.
Well, and
you know,
it's because that's where we
for
kinda,
that movie
for the Blair Witch Project.
And it's interesting how because the Blair
it's
Witch
insane.
Project they did it so well because I was reading on Wikipedia if it's right or not. The filmmakers mentioned they got the idea because they were big into the paranormal and the documentaries and films. And they were it was like a quote I'm paraphrasing from Wikipedia, but they found almost the paranormal documentaries they were watching were scarier than the actual
scary movies. Yeah, right.
So they're like they did it right because I mean obviously Paranormal Activity also was a huge success,
sure.
But very other few like found footages I feel like have been able to merge like the almost documentary storytelling
with
just shaky, this happened.
Yeah.
Chronicle was great. It was found footage, but it also they bounced around a lot. It wasn't like it was a documentary
footage
of a film.
Chronicle, like, for sure plays like pretty loose with it.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of when, you know, you could see like, oh, this is something that we can do for like every genre.
Absolutely.
You know, we can do a found footage superhero movie. We can do a found footage kaiju film with Cloverfield.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of but that's because those movies aren't really trying to be 100% real. And that's not to disparage them in any way, but that's just like, that's the style.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Eduardo and Dan and Greg, you know, they weren't really like horror guys.
Yeah.
They were just kind of like, you know, indie filmmakers wanting to tell various stories. And their approach to doing Blair Witch Project initially, by the way, the footage that's in the Blair Witch Project, the feature film, was only going to be about, I think, 15, 20 minutes of the feature film that they had planned, which was going to be structured like a much more traditional documentary.
Oh, okay.
Well, they shot like 13, 14 hours, right?
I think they had like 22 hours of footage or something. Yeah. And, you know, they sent the actors out in the woods.
Right.
And it's, of course, quite like legendary now how they made the film. But they also, you know, if you watch the documentary that they did with their production designer, Ben Rock, which is called The Curse of the Blair Witch, it's all footage that they shot for the film that they thought was going to be the Blair Witch Project, the historic interviews with Rustin Parr and things like that.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of like, if you fuse the Blair Witch Project with that film... And I know there's like some planned 2.5 hour kind of cut that they've rumored that they might eventually put together if they can get kind of all the rights and image rights and everything figured out, which obviously Adam and I would like love to see.
Yeah.
I think if you fuse the Blair Witch Project with the Curse of the Blair Witch, that's kind of the closest thing to what their original plan was. But like the footage that was shot by Heather Donahue, Josh Leonard, and Mike Williams out in the woods was so just kind of bracing that they edited that together almost to kind of raise the money to do this larger project. Mm. And then I think, and I might be totally wrong about this because there's varying kind of versions of this chronology, but it ended up like everyone was like, no, wait, this is the movie.
Oh, wow.
Like, this is the movie right here. It's just like, you know, this like intimate kind of like lost in the woods experience.
And was there an angel investor that stepped in and was like, we'll give you this much more money to make it better? Or was it like the studio right away?
Well, I think it was Artisan bought it. I think Artisan bought it before Sundance. And I know, and actually Amy Nicholson, the film journalist and writer Amy Nicholson kind of informed me about some of this because I even didn't know this stuff, but they filmed kind of like a Paranormal Activity style reshoot ending where like Mike is found like crucified in the house.
Oh, wow.
That was like a much more like gory on the nose horror ending. And then they were like, oh, well, that didn't work.
Mm.
And that was like a studio trying to make it a more conventional horror film.
Yeah.
So there were the budget varies partially because, you know, so much work was done on the sound mix, which is fantastic, and the score, which is also really interesting, and things like that. Again, you know, these are like, you know, there really hadn't been anything like it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but I don't know. I don't really know where the financing came from or how that came about.
It's interesting because, like, the Blair Witch Project is widely considered one of the first films promoted on the internet with like viral underground type of marketing and rumors and all that. And I remember I would have been a junior or maybe a senior in high school when it came out. And I come from a small town in Michigan, and it was at the advent of the internet and the websites, and the Blair Witch Project website had like fake interviews with cops and like missing children and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So when I seen it, I had to drive like 35, 40 minutes to a theater to watch it because it wasn't a huge wide release thing. And I was still under the impression that it was a real thing.
Nice. Right. Yeah.
And it was great.
I knew it was fake before I saw it, but I mean, I kind of wish I'd had that experience.
Yeah.
You know?
Like
someone had told me, you know, like, oh, it's this like fake documentary, but it feels really real. And,
yeah.
And like people are debating it. And that was after Sundance premiere, before I had a chance to see it in theaters. Again, cause I was in film school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, so other film students were talking about it, especially because, you know, that was like, that's like the number one inspiration to like, you know, amateur filmmakers.
Oh, absolutely.
The Blair Witch Project is this movie that's like shot in this like really, you know, it does feel like you could do that.
Yeah.
You know, and certainly like, you know, it was made with so little resources that, you know, is an extreme inspiration.
Yeah.
So, but I never got to have the like, oh my God, like, is that real? And kind of like, you know, but at the same time, the film is so authentic that that at least while you're watching it, you're always 100% able, in my opinion, to suspend disbelief.
And what a cool opportunity for you to be one of the ones in charge of carrying on that story.
Yeah.
What can we expect in this one? Like, does it kind of follow the same?
It's a very direct sequel. Yeah. I mean, because that's what we felt like we'd wanted.
Yeah.
Back in 2000, 2001.
Yeah.
We wanted to see the mythology not explained, because that would in some ways really ruin it.
Sure.
But kind of just further expanded upon and explored, and so it's a very direct sequel. I mean, it's the plot that Lionsgate kind of suggested to us, and Adam and I were like, yeah, sure, like uh-huh. that seems like the right approach. Was the younger brother of the Heather character. All these years later, thinks he might have found a clue to what happened to her and goes out to the woods to pursue that.
Oh,
and so
cool.
That's the end point of our story. Mm-hmm. So it's a very direct sequel.
Cool.
And because I felt like we felt a little bit that, in making a sequel all these years later, we kind of wanted to follow the path of the first film a little bit, because mm-hmm. it's not like everyone who sees the movie this weekend, assuming in fact that anyone does.
But everyone.
But I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful. Yeah. By the time you hear this, I guess you may know.
That's right.
But yeah, I mean, assuming everyone, we assume that everyone who sees the film this weekend, like, some people will know the first film very intimately and be diehard fans, but a lot of people probably won't have seen it since it came out,
right.
or maybe will have never seen it.
Right.
And so, so the film has to kind of play for all those audiences,
right.
and that was our intention, as you
know. It's almost 20 years, I guess.
Almost 17, I think, right? Yeah. It came out in 99?
Yep, 17 years since it came out, yeah. And so the first film also takes place in 1994,
uh-huh.
And our film takes place in 2014.
Okay.
So there's a 20-year narrative jump for ambiguous reasons.
That's
you're
cool.
just like, yeah, 20 years seems right.
Yeah.
There is like a weird 40-year, 50-year thing built into the Blair Witch mythology, but we didn't want to wait that long.
Yeah.
but on the other hand, by then it would have been much easier to make a found footage movie, because by then we'll all just have like cameras implanted in our
sure.
eyeballs and just be recording everything.
That's right.
To a chip in our cerebral cortex, mm-hmm. and found mm-hmm. footage will be easier
Google
to do
Glass
then.
And all that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, we'll just be cyborgs.
This reminds me, we may not want to get to this just yet, but like, you're a licensed private investigator?
I have that noted here. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Perfect. Well, I'm glad you're bringing this up.
Well, I mean, with all the... which came first? The screenwriter, actor, director, filmmaker, or like, I want to know more stuff
and
about...
Yeah, and also, what was the craziest thing?
Yeah.
Names excluded.
Or included.
Or included, if anybody I know.
I mean, it was never a career path.
Did you work by? Did you have like a so-and-so PI?
Did you have a magnifying glass that was bigger than your face?
I have like a PI. I mean, I have a PI organization name, but it's just a DBA. It's not like an LLC or anything. And but that's to keep my license active, because why not?
Uh-huh. Absolutely.
I worked hard to get it.
Yeah.
But it was just a day job. Truthfully, I've met some of my closest friends there, and I'm still friends with a lot of people that I worked with for all those years. But it really was, I was making 16-millimeter films in high school, I was shooting and directing and editing myself, and I always knew I wanted to make movies. But after college, being like most people, I was broke.
Yeah.
And needed a job.
Sure.
And, and honestly, just truthfully, the story's even like lamer than like I was like, the ideal day job would be working as a PI, because I didn't even really know what that meant.
Yeah.
Outside of like Raymond Chandler novels and so on, so I got placed by a temp agency to redo the filing of a PI agency.
Come on.
Get the fuck out of here.
It was like my second thing, like they it was like the, I think it might have been the first gig they sent me out to. I was like, applied to a couple temp agencies, and they sent me to PI agents. They sent me to a PI company because they needed to have all their files reorganized, and it was a 1-week job.
Yeah.
And I did it. And at the end of the week, they were like, "Hey, how would you like to be an investigator?" And I was like, "What's what?" And they're like, $13.50 an hour. And they're like, I was like, "Yeah, heck yeah, $13.50 an hour, yeah."
Uh-huh.
I still remember that number, quite vividly, because
sure.
I was like, "Absolutely." That was actually here in Los Angeles, and then I ended up doing the job when I was living in Brooklyn for a couple of years, and then moved back to LA when I started selling scripts. And it was a great job, because I ended up largely working for them as an independent contractor, which meant I could just be like, guys, I'm going off to make a movie for 3 months. I'll be like, don't give me any more cases.
Wow.
I'll finish out the ones that I have, and I'll call you guys in like 3 months when I'm ready to get more work.
Right.
And they were really cool with that. I mean,
Wow.
It was a wonderful company run by generally pretty wonderful people, and I was very lucky to, you know, because I, you know, otherwise I don't know what I would have done,
right?
You know, because I mean I didn't have any connections, sure, in the entertainment industry.
Initially, was it like you were doing a lot of work for other people, like investigating like different things, or was it like you would have the same person or the same case and you would stay on that for like months on end?
I mean, most of our clients were like attorneys who worked in turn for like corporate clients, so okay, we were mainly doing like corporate work. Uh-huh. I guess you could call it kind of corporate espionage in,
yeah,
some way.
Sweet, I will. Yeah. I'll call it that.
But it was, yeah, like, uh-huh, the least sexy version of that you could possibly conceive of.
Yeah, and, but if you use the word espionage, it all of a sudden becomes sexy.
But that's kind of what, like, when people say that, this is kind of what they mean, which is this kind of like, you know, the kind of research that they can't really do themselves, but will hold up in court. You know, in terms of trying to find out what their rivals or other people are doing. Mm-hmm. And so the great thing about the job, you know, speaking to this podcast in particular, is, you know, I always had to fake expertise at certain things. Mm. So it was obviously an intellectually stimulating job for various reasons. And generally, you know, if there was anything like ethically compromising, we could turn
it down. Were you a pet detective and that's why you know so much about creatures?
No, I just love critters. Uh-huh. You know, they're funny to watch online and, mm-hmm, you know, videos and, you know, GIFs and stuff. Mm-hmm. No, you know, I don't know. I guess I read a lot, and I always have. But yeah, I mean, the good thing about that job is you were always learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, you were always learning how like various industries worked, and sometimes it would be like an overnight thing, you know, and they'd be like, all right, you have to like figure out how this industry works and pretend to talk knowledgeably about it.
Wow.
You know, in 2 hours, and you know, and so I got really good at you know, internet searches.
Like
and so
to brief
on
the staff, you weren't testifying.
No, no. I mean, I think I was deposed a couple of times,
oh,
but
wow.
I never really. I was actually very lucky in that. None of my cases ever led to like really serious trials or anything,
right.
Because I did have some of my colleagues, you know, whose stuff ended up like in court for months, and that's just
right.
Tedious and stressful. And, right. And I was actually really lucky. I mean, my reports were always quite clear, so there wasn't a lot of ambiguity in them. But yeah, I was deposed a couple times, but that's stressful too.
Mm-hmm.
But not a big deal.
Did anything floor you? Like, did you find something while you're investigating and be like, no way?
You know, I've blocked so much of it out. No, I mean, not really. It was more just like, this is so weird that this is the way this works.
Yeah.
You know, I remember I really can't talk about actually anything in particular that I did.
I love that. I love that.
I really can't. Like, I absolutely would.
Even with the names changed?
Yeah, no. Well, that's the thing. If I change the names, then it's not worth telling. Because I was just about to say, you know, I talked.
She's a similar company, like Pepsi Cola.
Well, no, I was about to like say
or
like
RC Cola.
I was about to say like I talked to the guy who invented like this one thing that we all know, but because yeah. it was a really cool random thing and it was fun talking to
the
him.
The Super Soaker.
It was like similar to that, but
Kush Ball.
Oh, that would have been amazing. No, but anyway, I mean that was it. You know, it was a day job, and I, you know, and no one would appreciate me talking about it in any real detail.
Fair enough.
You know, and I'm still friends with all those people. But you know, and it was a great job, but it was never you know, it was my equivalent of like, you know, working at a Starbucks or a gas mm-hmm. station or digging ditches or anything.
Did you ever
job.
Have to pay an informant?
No, I don't think I did. That's a great question. You know, sometimes we would job things out to other PIs, but I don't remember ever paying an informant for anything. Mainly because I don't think anyone that I was interacting with ever really knew what I was doing.
Okay.
Other than like the client directly themselves.
Got it.
You know, they wouldn't necessarily know why I was calling them or talking to them, you know. And so for me to be like, hey, listen, I need you to give me information, I'm going to give you money, would have given the game up.
Got it.
You know, and I think the job would be, well, I don't know if it'd be harder or easier to do now. I haven't done it for many, many years.
Yeah.
And actually, when I first started doing it, you know, it was pre, you know, it was like, I think February 2000. And immediately 9/11 actually made it a much harder job because immediately like the Department of Homeland Security kind of you know, took over a lot of the databases that we'd been using to track people down, and you know, you couldn't use those as just a licensed PI anymore. So it's getting harder, I imagine. You know, and so I'm very lucky that I'm able to make a living the way that I am, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, I'm very fortunate, you know, to come from, you know, the background that I have, and be making a good living in the film industry. It's not that common.
Yeah.
Truthfully.
Did you ever have to have someone, can you did you ever say this to somebody? Can you trace this plate for me?
Oh, yeah. 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 I mean, police departments will trace license plates for private investigators. But you have to go to the police for that.
Yeah.
You cannot access those databases yourselves. However, they will accommodate you if, I mean, if they're in the mood,
yeah,
truthfully. Yeah. I mean, like, I had that happen, I think, a couple times. But even then, I was like, hey, you know, I'd go to, like, a colleague who was like, hey, you have your contact at the police department. You know, can you see if they'll run this play, you know, and then they'd do it. But I never really actually figured out how that happened. And it really did feel like, you know, if I called the police station here, I was like, hey, I'm a licensed private investigator. Here's my ID number. Can you run a plate for me? I think they'd just be like, you know, why? Or they'd be like, yeah, hang on.
Yeah.
Or they'd be like, no,
yeah,
you know, we're busy.
Whatever mood,
you know, I mean, because it really is like, as a PI, you can do certain things, but you really don't have any more right to arrest anyone, any citizen,
yeah,
you know, or anything like that. You know, you don't have any real legal authority.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so if the police want to work with you, they will. And if they don't, they won't. And a lot of PIs are kind of scumbags,
yeah.
You know, truthfully, you know, they're doing kind of sleazy stuff for sleazy reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're basically kind of, you know, like, you know, the documentary Going Clear, you know,
yeah,
they talk about, gosh, like the Scientology, Church of Scientology hiring all these PIs to harass people and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, that's yeah, you know, that's the kind of stuff that, like, if you call the cops and you're like, hey, I'm part of this here, and they're like, click.
Right.
I mean, look, Simon, you're being a real SP right now.
Yeah, well, sorry, buddy. Yeah, no, I mean, look, you know, it was funny watching that and being like because especially, and if you read the book by Lawrence Wright,
suppressive,
yes.
If you read the book by Lawrence Wright, which is fantastic, you know,
it's great book.
Basically, you know, it's like the worst of private investigators in that book, and I'm like, ah, no wonder everyone like hates us. But yeah, I mean, most cops, and that's the funny thing. If you say to a cop like, I'm a private investigator, you would think that they'd be like, oh, we're on the same team, but in fact, they're like, oh, you're like a criminal.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
You're a criminal who like hasn't been arrested enough to lose your license yet.
Oh, wow.
And in the case of what I did, it was very innocuous. It was really, truthfully, a lot of what I did bordered on market research.
Okay.
You know, a lot of the time, or clearance.
Yeah.
Clearance for brands or trademarks.
Yeah.
You know, that they wanted a PI to do just in case it led to litigation in the future, you know, rather than just hiring one of their interns to do it.
That's interesting.
So truthfully, what I did was quite innocuous and largely very boring.
Yeah.
But if I were to like try to play that card with the police department, it would really just depend on how it went or if they had to deal with like, you know, a PI in a negative capacity.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because you even think about movies aside from Magnum PI, you think of other movies about PIs and they're all very kind of like greasy hair, sleazy. They all seem to be like the sleazy kind of
guy. I mean there's an interesting paradigm. There's some truth to that. I mean, you know, Veronica Mars kind of aside, you know,
it's like there's,
you know, it's like anything else. There's good ones, there's bad ones.
Yeah.
But you know, it is a weird industry, because, you know, it's in between a lot of kind of different things legally. You're like, you're not a lawyer, you're not a cop, you're not a security guard, you're not a bodyguard.
You're a loose cannon.
Yeah. Well, you're just this kind of weird like person who's hired for very specific reasons. But the reality of it is that like 90% of those reasons are probably bad.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're stalking people.
Yeah, you're stalking people. You know,
you play by your own rules.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is you know, I never did this myself, you know, like Philip Marlowe. But no, I mean, we never did divorce work or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, but that is you know, a huge chunk of the business.
Sure.
I believe
that. And that sounds pretty soul crushing.
Yeah,
that sounds so depressing.
I help people get divorced.
I wonder if that would have a negative effect on your relationships. You know, like all day long, you just prove infidelity and nothing else. You don't have necessarily control, you know, over whether your clients are good people.
Yeah.
Right.
You know.
What their motives are that they're hiring you for.
Yeah. I mean, I would turn down cases that I thought were
immoral.
Yeah. 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 Which fortunately really only happened like a couple times.
Yeah.
Because we were all kind of politically on the same page at my firm. It was a good company. But I mean, it would occasionally come up where it's like, oh, I don't know. I don't know if I want to do this.
you're primarily into like thrillers and writing horrors and all that, right? Mm-hmm. Have you ever thought of writing like a horror movie about, or a thriller, about private investigators?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I guess I'd be a good person for that. You know, it hasn't come up yet. Yeah, maybe. It would really just depend on the story. I don't think inherently having a private investigator protagonist is like an automatically interesting endpoint. You know, obviously it's more interesting than having like, you know, a filmmaker protagonist.
Yeah.
But you know, but it's not, you know, inherently an interesting job as I you know really well firsthand. So maybe, I mean, you know, there's been a few good ones. Yeah.
What Blair Witch is out in theaters now. Go check it out, everybody. Go check it out. What are you excited about in the future now that you're done? You mentioned before we started recording that this was your last bit of press for this film.
It's my last interview related to this
film. What are we excited
film?
About in the future?
I'm getting a full night's sleep, you know, which I haven't done for a few weeks. You know, what am I working on, you mean?
Yeah, like, yeah. Well, or and just in general, like what – yeah, I mean –
yeah.
Is there anything you can talk about that you're excited about that you're working on?
You know, we do have a couple of things in the works that I'm very excited about, but nothing I want to talk about too much yet. But I will say that Adam and I are working on a remake of I Saw the Devil.
Okay.
That I wrote that I think I'm pretty much done with the script for. I mean, pending kind of rewrites and stuff.
Yeah.
That everyone's really happy with, and we're getting that kind of set up, and I think we're both really excited to do that because I think our version, you know, is going to be really different from the original, and I think it's going to be a really cool movie.
That's cool,
yeah. Good for you. What's your favorite horror movie?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it changes.
Top five
changes day.
Halloween.
Well, Halloween, you know, would be up there. I would say The Thing remake by John Carpenter and Bill Lancaster is a phenomenal film. Mm-hmm. Tremors.
Tremors is a good movie.
Candyman, mm-hmm. The original Night of the Living Dead. I always, there's so many. Reanimator is absolutely one of my favorite horror movies. Yeah.
Candyman. That was he was like a slave that would come back and kill you, right?
Yep. Yep. Yeah, based on a Clive Barker short story. The film's written or directed by Bernard Rose and with an incredible score by Philip Glass.
Say his name three times or something, right?
Yeah, I think five times. I think you have to say his name five times.
Do you have anything cool or repetitive that you do for Halloween? Like just that time of year? Like is there something about the time of the year that you – like do you watch a certain movie on Halloween or
– you know, actually, I do pretty often watch the John Carpenter film Halloween on Halloween, which is not that interesting. And I'll also pretty frequently watch Halloween 3 Season of the Witch, because that movie's amazing.
This type of year is really cool for you.
But you know what I actually try to do on Halloween is I try to watch a good classic horror film that I haven't seen. So like this year, I've never seen the original Cat People.
Okay.
I'm kind of saving that. Yeah. And that's what I kind of try to do. I kind of like... I kind of am getting too old to go to Halloween parties.
No, and, you're and, not. And, never.
And
never.
I don't really fit into my sexy cat costume anymore. and so more, as I get older, my ideal Halloween kind of is, and I don't live in a trick-or-treat neighborhood. You know, I live in an apartment in Los Feliz, so I don't get that experience either of like handing out, you know, candy to pre-diabetic children. increasingly my ideal Halloween is... assuming I'm not working, which, you know, 9 times out of 10 I kind of have been, you know, is just watching a couple great old horror movies. And,
cool.
You know, also we have the wonderful kind of privilege of living in Los Angeles of having all these wonderful revival houses. That do great screenings on Halloween, you know, from the Egyptian to the New Beverly to Cinefamily and all those places.
Yeah.
So sometimes I'll seek something like that out. Yeah.
Can I ask one more question?
Yes, you can.
Do you have nightmares?
Do you write about them? Sometimes I'll find them a little inspiring, just like a moment or something where I'm like, you know, oh, I should put that in a movie. Like actually, there's a bit in Blair Witch that was really concretely from like a dream that I had while I was writing it, where I was like, you know what? Like that kind of would work, where I was like climbing a tree and like I felt like there was something in the tree with me.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. And that was all the dream really was. I was climbing a tree at night. And then
it's
I
just
like,
the feeling.
And then I realized like there was something else in the tree, like moving like the leaves up ahead. And I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
And then I kind of was like, you know what? Like that would work in the film.
Cool.
I obviously, you know, that scene isn't literally in the film the way that I just described it, but you know, so sometimes I'll take some inspiration from that. But you know, dreams are interesting because it's like, you know, it's really just like what you. I think often your dreams are stimulated by what you've obviously been thinking about and worrying about during the day.
Sure.
So sometimes it is just a different way of creatively processing an idea.
Yeah,
that's
interesting
great.
To me.
Simon, where can everybody find you on the internet?
I'm Simon_Barrett on Twitter.com, and that's really it for me.
Not on Instagram.
No, I'm not. You know, though there was a fake Simon Barrett on Instagram for a long time. So basically, if you see me on Instagram, it's not me.
Okay.
I had to get them to take that account down, which is maybe I should get verified.
Got a higher PI.
Full circle.
Yeah. Verification. David,
what are you
excited about? What do you got coming up? And where can people find you?
Yeah, Flaked Season 2. We're going to start shooting first week of October. There's a possibility that I might have two films at Sundance this year, which is really cool. I think that's it for now. I just did a rap video, the Flo Rida's New Zillionaire. You'll see me in that first rap video ever.
That's great.
I don't know. I don't know if I should have shared that.
Are you a zillionaire?
Zillionaire is an undeterminable amount of money. So you could have $3,000 and can be considered a zillionaire.
Well,
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I'm David Sullivan on Twitter, David Sullivan on Instagram, and how about you, Razzle?
You can follow me on Twitter at my name is Razzle too. You can follow me on Instagram at my name is Razzle. The new season of the franchise, if you haven't listened to the franchise yet, you can check it out on howl.fm. Use the promo code franchise for a free month of Howl subscription. We got three seasons out right now. We got a Star Wars season, we're gonna have a Ghostbusters and a Captain America, and coming out in November we're gonna be taking on the Harry Potter franchise there. So check those out. Continue following me on the social medias. And if you haven't yet, take 2 minutes to go over to iTunes and give us a good review and give us a good star rating, and help us keep climbing those charts that we keep getting up on there. Thanks to you guys. And like us on Facebook. Today We Learned with Razzle and Dan, and all that. And if you don't yet, follow Dan, who's not here, on Twitter at OsseoFerocious. He's got a couple books out. Buy those things and all that jazz. And as always, Magnum P.I. is cool.
Thank you so much, man.
Thank you so much. Check out Blair Witch. It's in theaters now. And do all those cool things.
All right, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.